British cargo ship is hit by a projectile while transiting the Strait of Hormuz. What does this mean for other vessels and future oil and natural gas shipments? There is a new Democrat coalition in Congress. Centrist? Socialist? Establishment? There's so many labels these days. Caucus Chair Brad Schneider with the definition and some of the agenda. Hello, everyone. I'm Major Garrett in Washington. Welcome to The Takeout. Immigration rippled through the headlines today, and news about it all week has indirectly left Congress paralyzed. The Supreme Court's conservative majority today backed restrictive Trump administration policies affecting temporary protective status. This is of immediate concern to hundreds of thousands of Haitian immigrants and thousands of Syrian immigrants here under now revoked TPS protections. Why? Because deportation hovers menacingly over their futures. The High Court also sided with the administration on methods of seeking asylum. Specifically, how close an applicant needs to be American soil to do so. As I summarize these headlines, we should remember, the history of American immigration law is presumptively strict. We think of ourselves as an immigrant-welcoming nation, but the long arc of our laws runs counter to that. We are an immigrant-tolerating nation. Yes, our laws have periodically been loosened, but the totality of the laws on the books have allowed this administration to seek, often successfully, aggressive restrictions and applications of those laws going so far back as to the Alien Enemies Act of 1789 to drastically tighten current immigrant access to America. Our Jessica Levinson will join us on these Supreme Court actions. A note about Congress, it's gone, left town much earlier than it intended to. The Senate left yesterday, the House bugged out today. Immigration is the main cause. You see, President Trump keeps demanding legislation requiring proof of citizenship for voter registration and voter ID at polling places. The bill he backs would also massively curtail mail balloting. All this rooted in the hysterical, baseless lie that our elections are stolen and non-citizens vote in large outcome determinative numbers. Our elections, hear me now, are not stolen. Non-citizens do not vote in federal and state elections and have not affected election outcomes in those races, ever. There are enough studies and databases on those key facts that I just summarized to fill three reflecting pools, with or without algae. Trump says he won't sign a bipartisan housing bill until the Senate passes his favorite voting access bill. Well, guess what? The Senate can't pass it because there aren't enough votes to overcome a filibuster. Okay, Trump says, abolish the filibuster. Senate Republicans oppose that for lots of reasons. Tired of being badgered, the GOP-led Senate recessed yesterday for 2 weeks. Meanwhile, across the Capitol, House Republicans aligned with the president on the voting bill say they will not let any piece of legislation on the floor until the Senate, which they're not a member of, relents. House GOP leaders, seeing the Senate is gone, had no choice but to get gone too, at least until next week when the Senate will still be gone and their hands will still be tied. One other note. For the second consecutive day, a federal court has blocked Trump's efforts to impose his will on voting access via executive order, this time by trying to federalize voter rolls and restrict voting by mail. This was blocked, you see, because the Constitution reserves to states the power to administer and oversee elections. This is a constant since our republic began. The federal judiciary and Congress keep reminding Trump of this stubborn truth. With that, we turn now to Ed O'Keefe at the White House, where one of the themes this week has been stubbornness at home and abroad. Ed.
I liked your three reflecting pools with or without algae analogy there, Major. Look, the Speaker of the House, despite all this, was here today. And one outgrowth of this meeting that the two of them had, the President and the Speaker, appears to be a warning that he issued a little while ago on Truth Social. I think we have it to show people. It speaks to the point you were talking about regarding House Republicans aligning with the President on getting the Save America Act passed. and essentially threatening to hold up everything unless or until the Senate does. But the president a little while ago saying that House Republicans should unify and stop voting down rules or threatening to do so, in essence, blocking any other business from getting done until the Senate takes up the other thing. As he says here, giving power to the radical left in the House to control what goes up for a vote will make our outcomes worse, not better. No more grandstanding, please. So in essence, he's saying, let's stop fighting amongst ourselves, pressure the Senate to try to take up this legislation where insufficient support for Save America Act exists, and try to get some other things passed in the meantime. But the president himself made it difficult for Congress to highlight some of the work they've done just in recent days. There was supposed to be that signing yesterday of a bipartisan housing bill that's designed to make housing more accessible and affordable. And he canceled it because he wants the Senate to take up this bill that doesn't have sufficient support. So they're all pointing fingers at each other. They're all in disagreement. But the president could conceivably be allowing other things to get through and allow members of his party to go home and campaign on either partisan or bipartisan accomplishments. But even he is standing in the way of them doing that.
And Ed, on the stubbornness abroad front, the administration continues to aggressively defend the Iran Memorandum of Understanding. Yet this phrase keeps popping up, appropriate time. The president said it earlier this week about inspectors inside Iran on highly enriched uranium. And the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, said today the Iran Reconstruction Fund, which is very important to Iran, will be dealt with at the appropriate time. A lot of this stuff seems to be just sort of hanging in a vague, hard to define next day or week or month or so.
Which is part of why the president got frustrated with the handful of Republicans who voted for that resolution essentially opposing the war earlier this week. Non-binding, symbolic, but he said it sends a signal to Iran as we're trying to figure out all this stuff with them. We can't be giving them ammo to either drop out of or prolong the talks. So you can appreciate perhaps in that sense why the president was upset with fellow Republicans. The other big sticking point for the Secretary of State today is he traveled through the Middle East. He's been to the UAE, Bahrain, and Kuwait. Is the ongoing debate over whether Iran would really ever try to impose a fee or a toll on access to the Strait of Hormuz. And he says that's just a non-negotiable no-go place for the United States and, as he pointed out, the rest of the world. Because precedent is, and history is, that you just don't charge a fee to pass through a body of water that is international water, as is the Strait of Hormuz. And so all sorts of reasons why this thing's getting held. And that's why, when they talk about appropriate time, they're still withholding those funds, because unless or until Iran tells you we're not going to do that, they can't give them the money. Because what if they did give them the money and suddenly they threw up a toll booth on the Strait of Hormuz? You know, the administration would have been taken for a ride. And so, as you said, this is a tricky negotiation. It's why the Obama-era JCPOA took more than 2 years to negotiate, and why this idea of a 60-day timetable for discussions is one that most believe is going to have to be extended, despite the fact that the president's working against the American political calendar, which, of course, has a big due date come November.
Indeed it does. Ed O'Keefe, North Lawn of the White House. Thank you so much. Former CIA officer and Marine Corps veteran Elliot Ackerman joins me now. He's also, I'm happy to say, CBS News contributor, joining us from Milan, Italy. So my first question, Elliot, is how hot is it there? Are you doing okay?
It is hot, Major. It feels probably a little bit like Iran in the summertime. So very, very hot here.
All right. I mentioned in the cold open of this program, Elliot, that a British vessel reported today that a projectile hit it. There was no damage. No one was injured. But that certainly, of course, rattles people about what is or isn't going to happen in the Strait of Hormuz in the future. What, if anything, can we conclude about what we know thus far?
I think what we've seen is that since the opening of this war in February is that the Iranians have very effectively weaponized the Strait of Hormuz. So whether it's, you know, just firing a single missile all the way up to shutting down the strait entirely, they have discovered a new point of leverage that they can use against the international community and the United States. And they've been using it to great effect up to and including the incident you described today.
And there's a bit of confusion, and perhaps it's intentional confusion, Elliot, about whether or not Iran will try to impose a toll or an administrative fee or some other mechanism, possibly in concert with the Omani government, over future transit through the Strait of Hormuz. The U.S. says that's an absolute non-starter, but Iran keeps talking about it. It feels to me like this projectile was a way of saying, we have a way to deal with this, even if you don't like it.
I couldn't agree with that more, Major. I think, again, that is also indicative of the fact of that the Iranians now have this new point of leverage in the Strait of Hormuz, and they are going to capitalize on that, almost like it's a rheostat, where they can turn up the pressure as they feel is fit, and they can also turn it down as they feel negotiations are progressing. So, you know, that is one of the outcomes of this war, and the Trump administration is having to deal with that in this latest round of negotiations.
A quick reminder to our audience, Elliot, if it's just one vessel, it's not just one vessel. It sends reverberations through anyone who may send a vessel in to get new cargo or one still waiting to get out.
And that's right. You know, it's not necessarily the violence, the sinking of a ship. It's merely the threat and what the threat does to insurance premiums, to the willingness of international shipping corporations to send ships through the strait. It fundamentally changes the game, and it does so in international waters. And the Strait of Hormuz is not the only set of international waters that are under contention. We also have the South China Sea around Taiwan. So, you know, I would tell people, you know, be watching the news around international waters and what ships can do, because I think this is going to be an area where we see a lot of debate in the next couple of years.
Elliot, always great stuff. Please stay cool. And I know this goes without saying, you're going to enjoy Milan. Everyone does.
I will.
Paul Kane, who covers Congress for Notice, joins us now from Capitol Hill. Paul's a friend of the show. Paul, always good to see you. You've been around Congress a lot longer than I have. I've been around a while, but you've been around longer. This is a heck of a week in Congress when something that is ready to go has been passed by both chambers, large bipartisan majorities, hard to negotiate. I'm talking about the housing legislation and some of the key figures involved, conservative, liberal. A lot of things had to be compromised, put together, sent to the president. There's going to be a signing ceremony. The White House ballyhoos it, and then it all collapses.
They even built a different stage for it. They were usually it's done in the Oval Office. They came up with an idea of, oh, my gosh, what if we did this in Statuary Hall? In Congress, they were probably going to get some Democrats to show up. The bill was incredibly popular. It got like 85 votes in the Senate, north of 350 in the House. It was going to be a sort of spectacle that Trump usually revels in. But as you talked about in the opening, he just can't let go of this Save America Act, this bill that he's trying to make into a law that he doesn't have the votes to pass, that would basically try to clamp down on illegal immigrants voting, which is not really a problem, as you noted, but he can't do it. So instead of going up to the Capitol early to do this event, he fired off a tweet. I think he did it, from the residence. And then blew up that whole thing. Went into this lunch with Senate Republicans yesterday, got into a shouting match with Bill Cassidy. They spoke for almost an hour. He didn't take any questions, best I've been able to report out. Did not win any additional votes from senators to either pass the Save America Act or to blow up the filibuster. So he's stuck, and now he's saying basically that, you know, yes, he's freeing up the House to try and pick up on their agenda, but he's not saying, I'm going to sign the housing bill that they had set up.
Right.
He hasn't said what he would actually sign right now. He just wants the sort of rebels in the House to play nice with Mike Johnson.
Right. And, Paul, help my audience understand two things. There are different versions of the Save America Act in the Senate and the House,
yes.
Point one. Point two, in the Senate, it's not clear to me that even if, and it won't happen, but even if hypothetically it did, the filibuster were abolished, I'm not sure Senate Republicans have 50 votes for the pending legislation there.
That's one of those things that they don't like to admit publicly on the record, but you talk to them off the record. I think there are quite a few Republicans who do still believe in the federal system in which the federal government has a role and the state government has a bigger role in a lot of things, including elections. There are a lot of conservatives who are really, really not comfortable coming in and basically dictating a nationalized role on elections.
They're uncomfortable getting rid of or severely curtailing mail-in voting because many got elected through mail-in ballots.
Oh my gosh, rural Nevada, rural parts of the country rely incredibly heavily on mail-in voting. And doing away with that, mail-in voting was originally the Republican artwork. They mastered it in places like Florida with senior citizens. The Republican consultant class has always wanted mail-in voting. They don't want to restrict it. So yeah, he has a problem with the overall vote count in the Senate, no matter what the Senate rules are.
He's got a problem structurally, he's got a problem ideologically, and he's got a problem politically and practically. Lots of problems. Paul Kane, always a pleasure. You're never a problem, sir. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you.
We turn now to Supreme Court's decisions today on immigration. CBS News legal contributor Jessica Levinson joins me now. Jessica, start with the one on TPS, temporary protective status.
So let's see if I'm a problem today. So temporary protective status. What we have a majority of the court saying here, two things. But the primary thing is that when it comes to a decision by the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security to end temporary protected status for a group, maybe it's Haitians, maybe it's people from Syria, that decision is not reviewable by federal courts, at least with respect to non-constitutional claims, meaning the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security says, I'm ending this program. It's not up to judges to second guess that. The second part of the decision, the court said, we understand that there has been a challenge from people in Haiti saying that the way that this particular program was ended, that it actually infringes on their equal protection rights. And the court said, we don't think that they are likely to succeed on that claim.
And on the second decision from the court dealing with asylum and this idea of how close you have to be or what a port of entry is, or whether you're in Mexico, outline that for us.
So in both cases, we're talking about the Supreme Court looking at federal statutes and determining what those statutes meant. As we talked about when it came to the TPS decision, we had the Supreme Court saying, I'm looking at this language and I don't think judges get to have a second guess, a second look at what the Department of Homeland Security decides. Then when it comes to this question of arriving in the United States, the court does the same thing. They look at the language of the statute and they make a determination that a federal law that says if you arrive in the United States, then you can do things like seek asylum, that does not include people who arrive at the border, that you actually have to come into this country. And the majority of the court made a decision, again, based on the language of the statute, that arrive in the United States, which is the moment that you get these protections, that does not include standing on the side of the border saying, let me in.
Checking my notes, not a problem, Jessica Levinson, ever. Thank you so much. So to come on the takeout, Illinois Congressman and Chair of the New Democrat Coalition, Brad Schneider, joins us. There was a primary in New York State, rather. We heard a lot about it. He's going to get a chance to talk about the implications of that, what it might mean, and divisions within the Democratic Party. Also, Texas Democrats meet at the state party's convention. We will take you to Corpus Christi. Plus, what Louisiana Republican Senator Bill Cassidy told CBS News, specifically Margaret Brennan for Face the Nation, about why he reversed course on the Iran War Powers vote. All that and more, the takeout returns in 90 seconds. Welcome back to the takeout. Welcome to the Conversation Corner. The establishment wing, if that's what we're calling it these days, of the Democratic Party took a bit of a hit Tuesday's primaries. We talked about that earlier this week. Congressman Dan Goldman, Adriano Espiat in New York, both defeated by Zoran Mamdani. He's the mayor of New York City, backed challengers. Both representatives, it's interesting to know, were endorsed by House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries. That's where the establishment took a bit of a setback. Illinois Democratic Congressman Brad Schneider joins me now. He's chair of something called the New Democrat Coalition, which it says works to bridge the partisan divide. And it recently put forward a legislative roadmap should Democrats regain control of the House. We'll get to that in a minute. Brad, it's great to have you here. Thanks
Good
for coming
here.
In. Give me your sense of this increasingly visible and sometimes fractious conversation within the House Democratic Caucus to be, if you get the majority, even if right. you don't, they're going to come anyway, Democratic Socialists and more mainstream Democrats as you identify yourself.
Yeah, I think there is a tension. We saw it. And so Mamdani endorsed three candidates in New York City, very specific,
right.
close to each other in New York City. What hasn't got as much attention in a little further upstate New York, Kate Conley won.
She was on this program last night.
I know that, and she's a New Dem endorsed candidate. In Utah, Ben McAdams won his primary against three further left candidates. Mm-hmm. He won running away with 56% of the vote. And just over the border here in Maryland, Adrian Boafo won. Now, these were three candidates endorsed by the New Democrat Coalition. And New Dems also, Dan Goldman was a member of the New Dems, so we took a hit.
Right.
But with those three races that we won, we've added. Kate Connolly is coming to Congress. Ben McAdams is coming to Congress. Adrian Boafo is replacing Steny Hoyer. Mm-hmm. But we've expanded the Democratic caucus by two seats when they come to Congress. And we have 27 other candidates we've endorsed around the country that are expanding our caucus so we take the majority. So as we take the majority, it's moving to the middle.
You think so?
The numbers will move us to the middle.
Right.
At the same time, within the progressive side, what you saw in New York City was that, as you said, the establishment took a hit. You have the Democratic Socialists of America, which many don't identify as Democrats
at all. Right.
Right.
They just use it in their words as a vehicle.
It's their platform to get the camel's nose under the tent.
Right.
New Dems have grown. When we were founded 30 years ago, 1997, there were 32 people who came together and said, we've got to break through the gridlock and mm-hmm. get things done. And that's been our mantra ever since. When I came to Congress in 2013, there were 40-some members of the New Democrat Coalition. Today, we're 115.
Mm-hmm.
And with what we see happening and the election we're hoping for, we'll be 125, 130 members of the 225, 230 caucus.
Quick thing. You said Kate Conley's going to win. Mike Lawler, the sitting Republican congressman,
will
have something to say about that. So we'll see how the November results come in. But your point broadly is this is a small faction within the Democratic Party. However, from small factions, big things can come. And I would only remind you of what happened with the Tea Party on the Republican side.
Absolutely.
They became the House Freedom Caucus. They were the progenitors of what Donald Trump and populism in the Republican Party sort of took over it. So it doesn't mean it's not important. From small things, big things can happen.
We need to address the messaging. It's, they're promising castles and clouds and a form of socialism that doesn't reflect what we believe is the Democratic Party. But there's a key difference. So 2010, Tea Party comes, they wiped out 63 Democrats. It was a wave election. Mm-hmm. I came in the following election. As I mentioned, there were a little over 40 members of the New Democrat Coalition. There are a comparable number, maybe even a few more of the what was then called the Tuesday Group, the moderate Democrats, or moderate Republicans. They've shrunk to almost nothing. It's hard to find a moderate Republican left. They've been chased out. Donald Trump's had a very active role in chasing away the moderates. At the same time, the New Dems have grown. In fact, we're almost three times as big, and we continue to grow. So when the Tea Party comes into the Republican Party, and they could have ended up on either side back then, the center was on the decent, on the right side. As these people are coming to Congress, what we're still seeing is the center-left is on the ascent.
Is growing.
Yeah.
On the ascent. Okay. Let's get to this agenda, and I want to invite you back. We'll have a longer conversation about it. But you want to have a legislative roadmap if, in fact, Democrats take over the House.
Right.
What is it?
Well, the bottom line is people are frustrated. They're watching what is happening in Congress, and this is not new. And they're saying what happens in Washington, what happens in the Capitol, in the White House, has little bearing on my life.
They were frustrated when you were in charge with Biden, too.
Absolutely. And they're saying what's happening in Washington has little effect on my life. In fact, my life just keeps getting harder and harder. And we were talking before the show that our kids are about the same age. And that this generation of late 20s, early 30s, looking at beginning families, buying a home.
They feel stuck.
It's if not impossible, it feels really hard. We've got to give a message to the American people of all ages, working families, people starting out, people looking at the cusp of retirement, that they have a chance not just to make ends meet. We're sitting here at the 25th of June, and families are sitting down at the kitchen table looking at their account balances and looking at their bills and saying, these don't fit anymore. Well, I don't want them just to be able to pay their bills. I want them to be able to save for retirement, to plan for their kids' education, to take or kids' education and take a vacation. If they can do all those things, that's affordability. If at the end of the month there's not enough money in the bank to pay your bills, that's the crisis we're in now, from housing to healthcare to we're looking at the impact AI is having. We need to give them a sense that we'll give people a chance to get ahead. We're going to tackle the hard challenges we face as a country, and we're going to try to restore faith in government and clear out the corruption we're seeing in this administration.
It's a tight majority for the House Republicans right now, so if any defections arise, they are stymied. Do you imagine if you get the House majority in the next Congress and you have these Democratic socialists, you could be similarly stymied?
If we follow the rules the Republicans set. There used to be the Hastert rule. You had
majority, the majority,
the majority, the majority. And now it has to be is only the majority from the majority, right? Mm-hmm. Mike Johnson has to get 218 votes of Republicans before he can move anything until crisis confronts him and he says, all right, I'll work with the Democrats. Or the Democrats can convince a few Republicans to join us on a discharge petition to force a vote on something. I expect when Hakeem Jeffries is Speaker, he's going to say, we're going to try to craft policies that will make life better, and we're going to reach across the aisle and bring Republicans and Democrats together on smart policy and move it forward.
Well, we'll wait to see if that happens. Brad Schneider, been a pleasure, from Illinois.
Thank you.
Please come back.
I'll do it.
Texas Democrats are gathering in Corpus Christi for the state's party convention. And you can be certain Senate candidate nominee James Tallarico will be a topic of conversation. Others will be too, but probably no one more than Tallarico. That's next. You're watching The Takeout. Welcome back to The Takeout. Democrats from around the country convening in Texas for the party's largest gathering this year, state party convention. Big focus will be James Tallarico and the Senate race. Here's why. Latest survey finds Texas Republican Attorney General and nominee Ken Paxton leading Tallarico by 1 point. Basically, it's a tie because it's within the margin of error. CBS News political contributor Chuck Rocha is in Corpus Christi for the convention. We should note, full disclosure, he's an advisor to the Tallarico campaign and quite obviously living large in a hotel room with a particle board kitchenette and no wall art. So that's great. Good on you, Chuck.
How about that?
All right.
Welcome to the Homewood Suites.
So what's the Tallarico buzz? And you know what Republicans are already saying. Hey, Bernie Sanders is the keynoter. Therefore, James Tallarico is a socialist.
Well, folks are scared of James Tallarico because unlike in 2018 when me and you were covering Beto O'Rourke, Beto O'Rourke was never ahead or even really close, even though he closed the gap to just 2.5 points by Election Day. 2018 is looking a lot different than this election year. There's a lot of folks in Texas that are sick and tired. Now, the reason behind that, it's easy for a Democrat like me to go, oh, they don't like the Republicans. But no, there's a lot to that. Republicans have been in total charge of this state for 31 years. And yeah, they're going to attack Tallarico on all the social issues, call him low T, say that he's a mama's boy. They're going to say everything they can. But I just don't think this year of all years that it's going to stick when people are sick and tired of being sick and tired, when costs have went up, when we're in a foreign war that the president promised us we wouldn't be in. And in Texas, in Corpus Christi right now, right here, they may run out of water in a year. Like, there's a lot of crazy things going on in Texas.
Talk to me about the depth of unity among Texas Democrats and whether or not that unity will include Jasmine Crockett, who did not support, obviously, because she ran against James Tallarico in the primary. She's not going to be there. She could possibly be a holdout that might have a ripple effect among African-American men and women in Texas.
Jasmine Crockett is a dear friend of mine, and I love her, and she's a great Democrat. But just because Jasmine Crockett ain't at this convention doesn't mean that every black folks in Texas are not going to vote for James Tallarico. As James said, the night that he won, I was there. And the first thing he said into the microphone was not, I want to thank my mama. It wasn't, I want to thank the man who raised me. It wasn't, I want to thank my amazing team. The first thing he said is, thank you, Congresswoman Crockett. And I look forward to, this is important, I look forward to earning the support of all of your supporters, and I plan on working to get that. Not that I'm going to get it immediately, not that I'm the Democratic nominee and everybody should get in line, but I'm going to work for that. And that's what he's been doing since he won the nomination, and I think that's the real difference. And the other unity I'd like to point out, Major, is tonight at the convention, Bobby Pulido is the star that's going to be not only singing but speaking. Tomorrow night, Gina Hinojosa, James Tallarico, and then on Saturday, Senator Cory Booker, Senator Sanders, and lots of other folks from around the country. I've never seen, and I've been coming to these things long enough where this beard was black and I was skinny. There's a lot of excitement in the air.
And J.B. Pritzker, governor of Illinois, will be there very quickly. Chuck, historically, Texas has been an ATM, meaning sending money out. Is Texas going to pull money in because of these races are actually going to be competitive?
All those trial attorneys in Houston that do fundraisers for every bigwig that come through now are putting that money in the state. That's the biggest difference. And the number one fundraiser on AgBlue is James Mean Tallarico. That's going to be a big deal for all of us.
Chuck Roach, I appreciate the time. Enjoy that fabulous, sumptuous hotel room. Next, Louisiana Republican Senator Bill Cassidy flip-flopped. Well, he changed. He wouldn't call it a flip-flop on the Iran War Powers vote. And he explained it to Margaret Brennan. We'll tell you what he said when we come back. Welcome back to the Takeout, and welcome back to the Takeout Tavern, which, yes, indeed, we are very much falling in love with. The Senate yesterday rejected a measure to, at the margins, constrain President Trump's war powers in Iran. They did so after two Republicans switched their votes. Face the Nation's Margaret Brennan spoke with one of those senators, Louisiana's Bill Cassidy, about his decision and how he came to it and the shouting match he got in with Trump in that Senate Republican conference meeting earlier in the day. Here's a look.
So, Senator, as I understand it, the vice president and special envoy Witkoff gave you a special briefing in the Situation Room late Wednesday on Iran. What you heard made you change your vote. Why are you no longer trying to stop the president from resuming strikes in Iran?
That actually was not my original rationale for voting for the War Powers Act. My original rationale was because we were not being briefed. We could be the Senate, the Congress, or the United States. And I felt important that we be briefed. I agreed with the president's original goals. Those were not being achieved by my perception. Mm-hmm. And so before I could say, okay, everything's hunky-dory, I said, I need to be briefed. After the exchange I had with the president yesterday, I passed a note to Steve Witkoff. Steve, I would consider changing my vote, but I've been voting yes because I've not been briefed. He said, called me back in the hour. And let's have a briefing. We had it last night.
What did you hear that changed your mind?
So if the original objections were to destroy, degrade, if you will, Iran's nuclear capability, their ability to do a ballistic missile, and their conventional warfare capability, and we were supposed to be out of there in 4 to 5 weeks, with maybe a little bit of a sprinkling of regime change, that's how it came across. Mm-hmm. The regime change is off the table. That doesn't seem as if that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But it does seem as if the way they laid it out, the other three objectives can be reached. And with those other three objectives, now, we have to trust but verify. But as they laid it out, they have a plausible plan by which to achieve those. And that's what I was interested in.
You wanted to get the details on the diplomacy.
Correct.
Obviously, more of that conversation will be this Sunday on Face the Nation. I want to bring in our political panel, Democratic strategist Matt Bennett, Republican strategist Doug High. Welcome to the Takeout Tavern, gentlemen. It's good to have you here. And please feel free to imbibe at will.
So I remember Dean Martin, they say he used to have apple juice when people thought he was drinking
not
whiskey.
Apple juice,
is this
folks,
apple juice?
Not apple juice. But this, folks, you see it every day. It's always coffee for me. I keep my wits about me. Doug, what you just heard Bill Cassidy say is something you've heard in the Senate a lot. Treat me like I'm a senator.
Yeah.
Tell me what I want to know, and maybe I'll come back on the reservation. That's exactly what happened.
Yeah, this has been a long-standing problem for Republican senators and members of the
With this administration. They don't get a lot of answers.
No, and the perfect, I think, example or opportunity for the president would have been the State of the Union address to tell Congress and to tell the American people, here's what I want to do, here's how we're going to do it, and here's how we define success. Even with Trump, as calcified as voters are with him, they will give some benefit of the doubt, some leeway, if you tell them there's a plan. And Republican senators, even those who are and members of Congress, even those who are on the Intelligence Committee and Armed Services Committee, they don't get much information, and it's been a challenge for them.
Matt?
I mean, we're 4 months into this thing, and it took Cassidy yelling at the president.
And the president yelling back.
And the president yelling back for him to get a private briefing. We don't know what he heard from those guys, and the Democratic Senate doesn't know, and the rest of the Congress doesn't know. What we have heard over and over is a flurry of different goals for this thing. We're going to do regime change. We're going to get the nuclear stuff. We're going to do the missiles. We're going to get rid of their Navy. I mean, what have we gotten out of this? We've spent billions of dollars. We've used, you know, our crucial munitions that we may need elsewhere. 15 American lives. And the straits are still kind of closed. Gas prices
and
are still
a pending request
high.
Before Congress of some $80 billion to replenish what has been fired off in this conflict.
Exactly. And, you know, Trump is so chaotic that all we hear are different explanations every day.
I want to talk to you, Matt, because I know you have a perspective on this. What happened in New York and how important it is. Brad Schneider was on this program and said, no. Actually, centrist or more mainstream Democrats are becoming larger numerically in the House caucus. But that's not the headlines this week. And when you look at the Gallup poll that shows that the favorability approval rating of socialism among Democrats is 66%, capitalism is 42%. It appears there's a trend line within the Democratic conversation that I'd imagine you're not comfortable with.
I'm going to need some more.
That's why we have this. That's why we have this.
It was a rough night for my part of the party, without question. And the biggest problem is that the people that got that will be elected to Congress, those people will be members of Congress.
Yes, they're
That's
coming.
A D plus 36 district. They are dramatically far much more extreme than anyone we've seen on the left in Congress.
They're not before. Progressive. They're socialists.
Oh, no. They are radicals. I mean, one of them believes that we should abolish prisons and let murderers out of jail. That is not, you don't have to be a political genius to figure out how to weaponize that against other Democrats. And that's what
And they're stridently about. Anti-Israel.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, that has become.
Which is becoming a very big fissure point within the Democratic coalition broadly.
It is, for sure. And the people that supported them, that is, you know, you must be on the right side of that issue or else you are evil. The people they beat are progressives. They're members of the Progressive Caucus.
In good standing.
Right.
Non-scandalized.
Not at all. They're for Medicare for All. They're for all the things that you would think the folks on the left would like. But if you cross them on that one issue, you're dead to them.
Doug, I wonder if you see happening within the Democratic Party what you saw happening in the Republican Party circa 2010.
Oh, absolutely.
Tea Party, conservative activists, aggressive. They don't really care about the establishment or the party leadership or any of that.
Yeah, I think we're seeing the beginnings of a House Democratic Freedom Caucus. And when you say they don't care about any of that, it also means it's more about performance art than it is really issues. And they don't care for what the rules are. And part of this goes back not just to 2010.
And actually, there's a kind of authenticity, quote unquote, that comes from disdaining rules and establishment and leadership.
And if you listen to the language they use, forget the issue. It's decidedly similar to what we've heard from the Republican Freedom Caucus, which is we have to fight. Okay. What's the strategy? We have to fight harder. So do you have a plan to land a punch, knock down your opponent, win the round?
Get a
no.
victory?
Fight.
Right.
So I see like the old Bugs Bunny cartoons, you know, you're throwing your fists in a circle. You're throwing a lot of punches, but are you landing any? And that's, I think, going to be the challenge is actually getting results.
Matt?
You're going to see these people do a lot of cable news. You're going to see
a lot of social media.
A lot of social media.
More social media than cable news.
Yeah, I mean, this is the Marjorie Taylor Greening of the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. These people, are the pre-break with Trump, MTG, they're coming to Congress to make waves, not to make legislation. And they're going to cause problems for Hakeem Jeffries if he's Speaker, and they're going to cause problems for Democrats running in swing districts. Because
their statements, their histories will be used as bumper stickers against centrist Democrats running elsewhere.
100%. We saw this in 2020, where defund the police was used against people running in swing districts to great effect.
And of course, Doug, you would say Republicans, that's what you have to do.
Sure. But you know who just got a lot more interesting as a Democrat? AOC. How does she navigate? She was a big spark plug for all of this when she very shockingly.
With or against, yeah.
Right. How does she do that?
Doug, hi. Matt Bennett. Gentlemen, drink up. Next, our nightly look back at when CBS celebrated America's 200th birthday, how two legendary actors helped ring in our bicentennial in 1976. You're watching and very much enjoying The Takeout. Welcome back. After doing our bicentennial minutes last night from the Takeout Tavern, it occurred to me this is the best place to do that. After all, when colonists debated revolution or loyalty to the British crown, they did so quite frequently in taverns. Similarly, when tired and stressed out delegates at the Constitutional Convention tried to blow off steam or maybe even seek compromise, they often fled to a tavern. So, Takeout Tavern and Bicentennial Minutes, here we go. Last night, forgive us, we had a gremlin glitch. I prepared you for acting great William Holden, and you got not William Holden. Holden was among the biggest film stars of the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. His inclusion in the Bicentennial Minutes gave them a touch of old Hollywood glamour and heft.
I'm William Holden. 200 years ago today, John Adams asked Congress to coin its first gold medal. News of the British evacuation of Boston had just reached Philadelphia, and Congress wanted General George Washington honored as the hero of the hour. An artist was commissioned, but in the turmoil of the next few months, it was forgotten. After the war, Congress finally asked a French artist, Duvivier, to strike the medal promised to Washington. He did. One side honors Washington as the protector of American liberty. The other shows him watching the British leave Boston on March 17, 1776. General Washington finally got his medal, but not until 1786, 10 years late, and 3 years before he was elected president. I'm William Holden, and that's the way it was.
These historic minutes are sponsored each night by Shell.
Can't leave out the Shell sponsorship stinger. Again, these were aired in 1974, 1975, and 1976. There were 912 bicentennial minutes in all. And if you were in a living room across America in those years, you were never sure who would appear. But like with Holden, there were some Hollywood glory surprises, such as Joseph Cotten. His film credits include classics from Orson Welles and Alfred Hitchcock, Citizen Kane, The Magnificent Ambersons, The Third Man, Shadow of a Doubt, and Gaslight. Yes, that last one is actually where we get the term gaslighting.
I'm Joseph Cotten. 200 years ago today, George Washington made one last effort to secure a scorched earth policy for Long Island. He told the New York legislature the British were desperate for food and would be certain to seize the huge stocks of cattle and grain on Long Island. Washington wanted the cattle removed, the grain destroyed, but many of the legislators owned land on Long Island and had to feed their families, so they balked at Washington's appeal and did almost nothing. Of course, the British would soon invade Long Island, grab all the food in sight, and give the Americans a hard lesson in military occupation. I'm Joseph Cotten, and that's the way it was.
Before we say goodbye, rest in peace, David Clayton Thomas, lead singer of Blood, Sweat, and Tears. He died today in Toronto at 84. David, as the New York Times said, was a homeless Toronto runaway who learned guitar in prison and fronted one of the most beloved rock, jazz, and blues bands of the late 1960s. There'll be one child born in this world to carry on, to carry on. Happy Thursday, everyone. This is The Takeout. Relentlessly curious, reliably civil, occasionally clever.